Where when I looked at the schedule that there was a good likelihood that at least two people in this session would talk about the same thing. So I decided that rather than repeating Rob, I would try and take a different path. So what I'm going to do to begin with is I'm going to talk about a variety of beasts of mesons that we can describe holographically at t equals zero. And I hope that that will do a number of things. Of course, if you want to study finite temperature, you need to be able to understand what's going on at t equals zero. I hope that those of you who are learning about these D3D7 systems will find this a useful set of ideas, a broader way to understand things. And I also hope that looking at the beasts that are out there, you might have some new ideas for what we should be looking at finite temperature. Now, that isn't to say that I'm going to ignore the heat bath. I'm going to come to that towards the end, and I'm going to revisit the phase transition that Rob was talking about and meson melting, and I'll try and just add to some of the things that he said. Okay, so the basic AES-CFT correspondence comes about from thinking about the open strings tied to a set of D3 brains. And the point about that is that both ends are tied to the stack of N D3 brains, and therefore these are in an N-bar representation. They're all adjoint fields. If you want to include quarks in the fundamental representation, what you have to do is to rip one end of one of these strings off the D3 brain and stick it somewhere else. And Karchin Katz taught us that a good place to stick it was on a D7 brain. Okay, so this is the setup. This is a sort of a scan showing where the brains live, and let me just talk you through it relative to the picture. So first of all, the direction along the D3 brain, that's 3 plus 1 dimensional space, the D3 brains live there, the D7 brains live there, and therefore the strings between them can move throughout the whole space and the quarks live in the 3 plus 1 dimensional theory. There are then four other directions on the D7 brain, which are these ones here, and I will call the radial direction on that in that direction rho, and it's a radial direction in ABS, so it's like an energy scale of the field theory. Finally, there are two directions in which you can separate the D3 and the D7, shown by the up and down direction. As you can see, if I separate them, I get some minimum length string, and that's telling me that the quark has some mass, length times tension of that minimum length string. Okay, in most of what I do, I will treat the D7s as a probe, and that corresponds to quenching, and the best way to think about that is that the gravitational background generated by the D3 brains is supposed to be dual to the gauge configuration, and now what I'm going to do is I'm going to not allow the D7 brain to change that, so obviously I'm not including quark loops in the gauge configuration. Okay, so how do you work out where these things like to lie? Well, you just treat them as soap bubbles. You use what's called the Dirac-Horn-Infeld action to minimize the world volume of the D7 brain in the geometry generated by the D3 brain, and we find out where they like to live. And what you find in ABS is that the picture I've just drawn is what you get. They like to lie flat as shown. Okay, now as Rob and David and so on showed us in great detail, you can find the fluctuations of these D-brains and from that get the meson spectrum. And I immediately want to stress a point. I said that this separation here told you about the quark mass. So why is it that fluctuations have something to do with the mesons? Well, that's something that always happens in holographic theories. Here, for example, we were talking about a scalar field whose value, so the separation is a scalar field on the surface of the D7 brain, that field is playing the role of the quark mass, which enters into a field theory in this sort of fashion. But you can see that this must be symmetry invariant, so psi bar psi must have basically the same symmetry as F up to a star. So the supergravity field, which really basically knows about the symmetries of the theory, can't distinguish between M and psi bar psi. And so you always get this duality that if you can describe source You can also describe the bed for the operator. So fluctuations of this brain can be chosen so that they look like fluctuations of side by side and describe mesons. Okay, so I look for solutions that perform a plane wave in the 3 plus 1 dimensional space, some function in the radial direction on the D7 brains. I get an equation of motion, and you can solve it, and it's only got good solutions for discrete values of k squared equals m squared, which are given by this, and I missed the square root out in the same way that Rob did. Okay, so the masses of the mesons, of these scalar mesons, come out as 2m, basically over the square root of the Tuff coupling, which is, of course, very un-QCD-like. The meson is much lighter than the constituent core. That was quenching, and we always say that going beyond the quenching approximation is hard, but actually there are geometries, for example, this one by Kirsch and Baumann, describing the full D3, D7 geometry, and you can write them down, and for example, you can see that there's a function here which is describing how the flavors renormalize the gauge coupling as you move in the radial direction.
There's an expansion in there?
This is, I believe, the exact solution for D3, D7 system. Now, I always assumed that this was a horrible mess and that one shouldn't play with it, but my student Ed Grofel walked into my office a couple of weeks ago and actually showed me that you can analytically embed a probe D7 ray into this geometry. You can show that it's flat, and you can go through all of the analysis of the meson spectrum, and you get exactly the same functional form up to a correction that comes from the number of flavors, and basically it's just a renormalization or an average over the renormalization of the coupling. So for those people who are interested in going beyond the quenching approximation, it does appear that you can actually do sensible analytic calculations there.
What is D?
D is the position where the D7 lanes are. So it's basically the max of the D7 lanes.
Doesn't that geometry have a singularity that needs to be resolved?
So it's singular, but it corresponds to the Landau pop, which you expect to be. Right, so when you put quarks into a conformal field theory, the gauge coupling blows up in the culture bubble. Okay, the next thing I want to do to get my next piece is to take one of these things and get its mass to be zero by making it into a Goldstone boson. So generically in the D3, D7 system, what you have to do is to break supersymmetry in order for a quark condensate to be allowed. So what you find, and there are actually quite a large number of geometries that behave in this way that are available now. For example, you can switch on the dilaton to put in a running coupling, or you can switch on a magnetic field, which induces parasymmetry breaking, and so forth. And what happens in these geometries is that you have some core of the geometry, the size of which is basically telling you about the mass gap in the theory, and that core is repulsive to the D7 brains. So when you try and lie them in flat, like you were doing in the supersymmetric theory, you find you can't do it, and the regular solutions, the allowed solutions, look like this, pushed out. So you can immediately think of this plot as being a plot of the dynamical quark mass against energy scale. So a string coming down from here to the axis, its length is basically the mass, and as a function of the energy scale, you see that it's enormous.
Can you explain why it is repulsive? Because normally it was attractive in this plot, right?
Well, that was a black hole.
Right.
This is a different sort of geometry.
Right. But why? So what is the size of this thing?
For example, if I switch on the dilaton, then what I find is that the dilaton runs to some pole in the interface reflecting asymptotically free gauge dynamics. And that geometry turns out to be repulsive. And the best way I can argue it is the opposite, which is it has to be in order to give Carroll symmetry breaking. But that's perhaps not the answer you want to. Okay, you see that asymptotically this solution is not flat, it actually looks like M plus a constant over rho squared. This constant has the same symmetry as M, but a different energy dimension, and it's exactly this point that this field can describe both this and this, and in this case, this parameter C, which we can read off as a function of M, is the chiral condensate. Okay, and there are other great examples of this, for example, in the D46 system by David and Rob. Okay, I really like these systems because you can actually dynamically see the symmetry breaking. So you're now looking at the plane in which you can separate the D3s and the D7s. The D3s live at the middle, and these blue lines are sticks coming in and out of the board. In the supersymmetric case, you can put it in straight and going through the D3 grain, and that shows you that you've got a zero mass core. Or you can put it so that it misses, and there's a minimum length string which is non-zero. And you can see that when you do that, you break the U1 symmetry in that plane. And that's telling you that that U1 symmetry is actually the axial symmetry of the quarks. Now, when we try and put a massless quark in the QCD-like case, we're trying to come in and hit this D3 grain, we get deflected out in this fashion, and it's clear that where we get deflected can be anywhere on a circle in this plane, and that circle is the vacuum manifold. You can immediately see that there's a pion. I can fluctuate the grain in that angular direction, and it doesn't cost me any energy. And indeed, if you calculate the meson spectrum as a function of the quark mass, what you find is as the quark mass goes to zero, you get a Goldstone boson, and you can show all sorts of nice things like its mass scales like the square root of the quark mass. Okay, I can't resist at this point trying to cause a little bit of controversy, so I'm going to talk about an alternative model of chiral symmetry breaking due to Sakai and Sugimoto, which I'm going to boldly say has been horribly confused in the literature. Let me tell you first of all about the bits that everyone agrees about. So this is an example of a theory where the gauge configuration comes from a wrapped D4 grain. So it's a D4 grain, one dimension is wrapped to give a 3 plus 1 dimensional gauge theory. You put the quarks in by putting a D8 and an anti-D8 grain in. They fill the whole space, except for one dimension, and you choose that to be this circle. So for example, you can have one at the top and one at the bottom of this circle. The claim is that there's an SUN symmetry here and here on these flavor grains, and that that's a chiral symmetry. If you want to get a strong coupling, you replace the D4 grains by the geometry that they create. And what you find is that you get a setup like this, you find that the DH can no longer get down to the D4 grain, so there's a mass gap. The string from here to here can't be zero length. And furthermore, the D8 actually combines with the D8 bar to become a single grain. And so you can see that there's chiral symmetry breaking because now I've only got one SUN gauge group. Okay, so asymptotically, for this configuration, this thing is just completely flat, and it looks like the embedding is, so tau is round, I've got the mark there, tau and z is just a constant. If there's chiral symmetry breaking, there should be a pion, and it turns up in a very interesting and different fashion in this model. It turns out, okay, so the embedding is real, so you can't put a phase onto the condensate, which is what a pion is, by doing something to this embedding. Instead, it shows up as a gauge field living on these D8 grains. So basically, it's the component of the gauge field that lives in this z direction. It's massless, it's a gauge field. In fact, you've got enough gauge freedom that you can fix its form easily on the D8 grain and then integrate over z, and what you end up with is just a massless four-dimensional pseudoscale. That's the point. Okay, so this is all good, but then there are another set of configurations where you switch on an asymptotic thing like this, and these things don't go as far out, they're not at the antipodal points, they sort of go along the edge of that cylinder in the way that I've drawn. Obviously, they don't come in as far here, so this string is longer, and it looks like you've introduced a max, you would think. Well, I want to claim that that is true, but a lot of people in the literature are claiming that that is not the case. And the main reason for that, I believe, is that Sugimoto has pointed out that even on these embeddings, there is that gauge field and it's massless, so there appears to be a pile. So people have been saying that in this theory, the chiral condensate, because you've got chiral symmetry breaking in each case, is a free parameter. Well, that would be a very peculiar gauge theory if you could have a chiral condensate which was infinitely bigger than the mass gap of the theory. It also seems completely daft because, as we've seen, whenever you have a holographic field and you can describe a source, you can describe an operator and we can describe chiral symmetry breaking, you've got to be able to describe the source. So, what is the resolution to all of this? Well, I claim that these do indeed represent a mass, and what I want to do is just explain to you why the pion that they think is there is not real.
I'm confused by the previous picture. Is it so, you mean you have multiple solutions at the same setting, or just some moving solution?
No, they're multiple solutions, and I'm claiming that what differentiates them is coordinates.
But then we select the one with the smallest free energy and the
C. No, because the core mass is something that you get to choose in the Lagrangian. The string theory might have some preference over what it should be, but if you're looking at the field theory, it's
so in any case, you pick up one of them, and four of them are chiral broken.
Well, okay, so that's the claim. But let me show you that there isn't a pile. Well, there is, but it's massive. You have to be careful about how you holographically identify the condensate and the mass. And just as before, you should have a complex holographic field that describes these two complex objects. And we've seen that there's a real function tau and this AZ which is playing the role of a phase. And the natural thing to suppose is that this is the identification. If the mass is zero, AZ is a phase on the condensate and it's a pion. However, if the mass is non-zero, this phase corresponds to both a phase on the mass and a phase on the condensate. And of course, if you change the phase of the mass, the vacuum is going to respond and change the phase of the condensate. So that is indeed something you would expect to find in the theory, but it's a spurious transformation because you have to be able to change the mass. You can't do that in any real theory. So if you want to find the pion, what you have to do is to change the phase of the condensate. And you can see that if I change the phase of this but not this, I have to change both AZ and tau together. And now we understand what happens, because tau is the embedding, that is the solution of an equation of motion, and there was a minimum. If I shift away from that by this amount, I raise the action, and I in fact find that there is a mass term for this pi field. So, and in fact, you can even show that it goes like the mass squared of the pion goes like the point mass. So, my claim is that since this, basically those are my arguments, and I think that this model, it's actually just very straightforward to include a point mass.
How about replication? Is it a relative to the pi squared?
Okay. I don't know how to calculate it because these are extremely singular geometries and the numerics is very hard. But I'll think of that if I can do it analytically.
Certainly. All of them are chirally broken, so they're not the goldstone pattern.
No, they're not. In these, you've explicitly broken chiral symmetry with quark mass.
So let's forget for a second about how you map the gravity description to the gauge theory. So there's a physical question on the gravity side about whether or not there are mass nf squared massless modes on those nf da planes. You're saying there are or there aren't?
No.
You're saying there are.
There are only massless ones for this case. The other one, well, I mean, okay. The massless modes on these are not physical because they correspond to you changing the parameters of the theorem. They correspond to you changing the coordinates.
So you're saying they're not normalizable.
They're field redefinitions.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. So the plan is massive, the larger massive.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Okay. I want to get on to some other things. So how long have I got? 10 minutes. Get over. It's 10 minutes. Okay. The final beast I wanted to talk about were heavy light mesons. I got confused about these as well. So if I had 2d7 brains and a very long string between them, people would tell me that in the semi-classical limit, the length times the tension of the string was the meson mass. But I've always been told that on the supergravity side, a mass for some object was telling me about the operator dimensions in the theory. I've resolved that contradiction, and both these statements are in fact true. If you just think about strings strung in this fashion, and look at their center of mass motion backwards and forwards, and just think about what their energy momentum relation looks like at large rho, well, it obviously looks like P for moving in the X direction, P for moving in the extra W directions on the brain, and M squared. But now three-dimensional analysis in the field theory. This is energy squared, this is energy squared, but W is an energy in the field theory. It's the radial direction in the space, so its canonical momentum is a distance. And so what you have to do is to put, well, what you find is that there's a factor of rho to the 4 that comes in there. So at large rho, this infinitely long string that you thought was infinitely massive is in fact massless. And what happens then is that if you convert this to a Klein-Gordon field, you get precisely the right solution to describe a mass connecting the heavy light fields and a condensate connecting the heavy light fields, which is what you would expect holographically. You can then take the Klein-Gordon equation and look for solutions for the heavy light mesons, and what you find is that, particularly in the large TUF coupling limit, that length times tension is still the main thing determining what's going on in the equation. So at large TUF coupling, you indeed find that the meson comes out to have a mass length times tension. But you can see the corrections in terms of the TUF coupling. And you can also, by this method, of course, get the excited states. I kind of wanted to just say that we make an assumption that this thing is a straight string, which is true when it's static. If you try and move this thing, though, and it should because it has some momentum in these solutions, you find that that brain bends. And I've loved some of these people who've been pushing brains around in thermal geometries to think about this. It seems to me that what happens is that you can't move this thing around without talking to the heavy and the light mesons. And it becomes a very complicated problem. But if anyone has any insight into moving these guys around, it would be great. I told you I would get to thermal transitions, so here I am. So those are the sorts of beasts that we have around. Oh, one more thing I should have said, because remember the light and the heavy mesons had a mass which was suppressed by lambda, square rooted, relative to the quark mass. Not true with the heavy light mesons. Very peculiar, they are just basically the quark mass in weight. The heavy meson is lighter than a heavy light meson. It's very peculiar. Okay, let's start to think about finite temperature. We all know that from Witten 10 years ago that what happens is that when the temperature gets bigger than the confinement scale of the theory, that suddenly a black hole appears, blocking your access to energy scales below the temperature, and that this is the deconfinement transition. So basically what you end up with in these theories at high temperature is an ADS black hole and your D7 brain. So now we can look and see what's going on there. And there are a set of embeddings that Rob has told you about. If you have guys down here, for example, if you have a zero quark mass, it just falls in to the horizon. That means the condensate is zero because this thing is straight, and there's no chiral symmetry breaking in this high temperature phase. Okay, and they keep falling in, and at some point you've got so high that they miss the black hole. And in between those configurations, there is a particular value for the quark mass where there are many solutions, some of which come onto the horizon, some of which don't, and which correspond to the spiral that Rob was talking about. So there's a first order transition that happens at that point. One thing I just want to stress is that if you ever take a supersymmetric theory with a moduli space and you perturb it, you really ought to check that you've got a stable geometry, that the moduli space doesn't run away. In this setup, the moduli space for giving the swarps of F corresponds to D3 grains dissolving into the D7 as an instanton configuration. So here's the action for that instanton configuration on the D7. Here's an instanton. And so, for example, of something that goes bad, if you put in a chemical potential on the brain, and you look at what happens for very large Q-squared components, in the pure ADS case, this term and this term for this solution cancel. That is, any value of the size of the instanton is allowed, and it's a moduli space, that's this parameter of the scale of F. When you, for example, introduce this chemical potential, this cancellation is broken, and you end up with net potential terms for your scalar Q-squared. And if you work it out for this case, you get the familiar runaway negative mass square for the scalars. So that's an example of the fact that you do need to check this. We checked it at finite temperature. What does the potential go like? It's got to vanish as t goes to 0. It's got to be dimension 4, so there can be a term that goes like t to the 4. The next term, just dimensionally, has to go like t to the 8 over q to the 4. So you calculate this coefficient, and it turns out that it is in fact positive with this minus sign there, and so asymptotically, this potential is preferring small things. Alright, I'm going to leave the rest of that and just say, so we've been working on this for 3 or 4 years now, and I have to say that I think all of us really fluffed it, because you go to the lattice guys and you say, okay, I want you to do a quench calculation with a heavy quark, and their eyes light up. And then you say that you want to find a phase transition, and they look at you like you're mad. Okay, so that does not exist in QCD. So the question is, what does this have to do with QCD? And we've learned the answer to that in the last 4 or 5 months from these gentlemen. And they've actually shown us that this corresponds to meson melting, which at least is something that happens in QCD. So how does this work? There are mesons up on these brains just because they don't really know too much about black holes, so that's like the standard calculation. But down here, you find that there are no solutions for any k squared equals m squared that are regular. Instead, what you find are quasi-normal modes, so basically waves that are flowing into the horizon of the black hole. And what those tell you about, what the numbers you get out of that tell you about is the lifetime of the mesons as they melt. So an example of something that one of my beasts that we haven't really talked about before at this meeting that would be interesting to look at is this melting for a heavy light meson, one of these long strings. Of course, you know what the answer is. This heavy light meson will melt to a heavy quark. But it's kind of going to be an interesting calculation to do, and I haven't done it yet. But this end of the string is going to behave like a heavy meson up here, and there's going to be a mass associated with it. But down at this end of the string, it's going to behave like a light quark or meson, and it's going to decay into this horizon. And I'm interested to see how that works, how it interpolates along the length of the string to do that analysis. have a minute. Nobody has shown this picture yet at this conference, so let me do so. This is just a reminder that we're really lacking asymptotic freedom in these theories. And just to point out that there is a way of, in the strong coupling regime, recovering the knowledge of that loss of asymptotic freedom, and that's to get your higher dimension operators correct in this central region. So this is sort of the idea of perfect actions on a very coarse lattice. We've had a few looks. For example, I know how to encode this operator coupling into gravity joules. I'd love to know how to do some more higher dimension operators, particularly this one seems to be relevant. So people might want to think about doing that game as well. Thank you.
I still didn't understand the main message neither from Robin from you. So there is something different between what we see in QCD and what we see here. In both cases we see melting, but in this case there is some other phenomenon which is a transition.
Right, it's associated with the phase transition.
And it's associated with phase transition, associated with the mass of a heavy quark, which does not happen in QCD. What is that phenomenon?
So basically, the point is that when the temperature becomes roughly of order the heavy quark mass, you get a transition, which is a jump in Q bar Q.
Touch point the square root of lambda?
Yeah. Yes, probably. Where should I have it? So you get a jump. You get these solutions and these transitions across.
Where you're the target, but not to zero. Somewhere.
That's right. So it's associated with that, but the only thing that really seems to connect to QCD is that it's the metal melting. So my guess would be it's a log N phenomenon.
So you know, why you don't have a QCD anything like that, it's just some square numbers.
I mean, free associating, in QCD this has to do, it has to do with the charm quarks and the bottom quarks. And the charm and bottom contribution to the free energy is very, very small. So if this phase transition has to do with anything, it would have to do with some phase transition associated with changes in the free energy on the scale of the charm and bottom contributions to the free energy, which would be some very, very small thing.
Correct. Well, we've never seen any of this continuity.
Could you just summarize again what you were saying about the connection between this and a score potential? I
skipped that. Okay, so you can work out the score potential out here accurately in the perturbation theory. This is the first interaction between the instanton and the deformation of the geometry. Working out what's going on in here is a little bit harder, and we just had a go at seeing what might be going on in there. So what we did is we took the basic instanton configuration, and in these perturbed geometries, we just asked what is its action lift as a function of the size that we use. And what we found was that for large temperature, for large temperature, we found that you get a zero scalar there, but at low temperatures, the scalar there switches on. And again, there's a first order phase transition. This has to be taken with a pinch of salt. We're assuming that configurations don't move too far away from the basic instanton configuration as a result of this change. So there could be other configurations of lower action that we haven't written down. But it just seems to show that the scalar there plays a role in this transition as well as a jump.
So when you talk about the heavy light system, presumably the meson form n equal 2 supermark effect that is lifted by the embracing symmetry, or do you see the whole mark effect, or do you see just one meson?
I think because of the semi-classical approximation, I've probably just sort of clumped all of these guys into one and I'm making the distinction.
So Edward, in thinking about if there's any analog in QCD of the jump, the question would be, at the temperature where J psi is dissociated, is there a jump at the C bar C, I mean, anti-charm, charm condensate? And that's, I mean, I don't know whether that's been, whether that can be.
No, because there are.
But I just
remember that there are.
When he said C bar psi, it's that condensate.
Krishna, there are very many levels. You yourself know that there is melting of some other states earlier and things like this. It would be infinitely many phase transition melting of a state would be similar. We know it is not. Yes?
This gets you into the Stewart scale.
Yes, that is too good to be true. So this phase transition is something which is not melting.
But at his transition, because it's large n and because as Rob stressed where Rob is sitting, because these mesons are deeply bound, there's this new scale m over root lambda. At his transition, not just one meson melts, but an infinite power will melt all at the same temperature.
Well, that means a macroscopic change. The whole cyber side changes. Yeah.
All of this is a large end phenomenon.
Right.
In the thermal setting, I mean, at any finite end, you don't have stable mesons. So
right.
All you're discussing is when you have smaller widths to when you have larger widths.
But it's a first order transition, so when I say if it exists infinitely, then it must exist up to some end, because it's a jump.
No. If it can get a sharper and sharper crossover, it becomes first order in the middle.
It's possible.
Well, nothing wrong with it. Yeah. It's factor of the basis
S. It's not there. Let's challenge our large M lattice people to find out the answer.
Okay.
Well,
we've got all the finite volume large M conditions are like that. They just want to show finite volume. They just happen to be infinity. It grows with the transition because n equals infinity, not finite.